from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The prize-winning bull, Full Flush, is a clone daddy times five. The big bull's DNA was injected into unfertilized eggs in a dolly-style transfer of genetic material. Now, the Full Flush clones, strapping biological copies of the original bull, are nearly ready to sire beefy offspring of their own. Their meat is not on your dinner plate yet. But in the next year, the FDA is expected to issue policy on the safety of incorporating clone offspring into the food supply. Ranchers and dairy farmers look optimistically at cloning as a surefire way to improve the quality of their herds. Opponents are clamoring to put on the brakes. How about you? Are you ready to have your burger come from the son of a clone? What questions would you need to have answered before you want clone offspring on the butcher board in the stew? Is cloning livestock a technological revolution that should be embraced or abandoned? You could join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Galesburg, Kansas, is Don Coover. He's been a rancher and veterinarian for 10 years and owns SEK Genetics, a meat cattle genetics company. Good evening and welcome, Don Coover.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I have to tell you, we first heard about this on Morning Edition on NPR earlier this week. It was a fascinating story about your big bull there and the clones that have been made from Full Flush. It made us want to know what's going on. We looked into it and found out there's a great big subject and debate here. We thank you for joining us tonight. I wonder if you'd just start by describing... Oops. Sounds like I may have... Sounds like I did lose Don Coover there. We'll come back to Don Coover in a moment. He's a rancher and veterinarian in Galesburg, Kansas, who will be back on the phone line shortly. He's got a great big bull, prize winner named Full Flush, who I hope he will describe for us in a moment. Before we get to him, while we're bringing him back, let me turn to another guest tonight, Michael Hansen. He joins us tonight from Yonkers, New York. Michael Hansen is Senior Research Associate at the Consumer Policy Institute. He served on the USDA Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology, and he's testified in Washington on biotechnology issues. Good evening and welcome, Michael Hansen.
Glad to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. We'll hear more from Don Coover in just a moment about what he's doing with his bull and its clones and when the meat of the offspring of those clones may or may not get into the American food supply. But top line, what's your view of this? You know farmers are saying it's a great thing. What do you think, Michael Hansen?
Well, our position on Consumers Union's position on cloning is that there are safety issues that are raised by the cloning process itself. So all the animals that result from this process need to go through a safety approval system before the milk and meat from cloned animals is allowed on the market. So there should be some form of mandatory safety testing and also labeling so that consumers can have a choice.
Testing and labeling. All right, let's lay that aside for a moment while we get a better understanding of exactly what's going on. Don Coover, are you back with us?
I am.
I'm sorry we lost you there.
No problem.
I was just about to ask if you could describe Full Flush and why this is such a famous and attractive bull.
Full Flush is a Kianina registered composite bull. That is, his genetic background is from three different breeds, so he's a crossbred animal, really. And the attraction of this animal to breeders is that he makes physiologically very desirable, very attractive, very efficient, beefy animals. They tend to be easy to feed. They're very attractive in the feedlot. This bull has won a following in the show ring. Calves sired by this bull are very competitive when those animals are shown in the show ring because he exemplifies the kinds of traits that the industry is looking for.
So you've got a wall full of ribbons somewhere that Full Flush won where?
Well, actually, I don't. The owner of this bull is Dean Kephart from Canute, Oklahoma.
Okay.
I work with Mr. Kephart to sell genetics on that bull and some other bulls that he owns, and actually from bull owners all over the country. But Dean Kephart has a wall full of ribbons and trophies that this bull has earned. And these bulls, actually this bull's offspring, wins these awards at things like the National Western Stock Show, which is a major show, sort of the Super Bowl of stock shows, mm-hmm. at Denver, Colorado every January. In fact, a calf out of that bull won the Fat Steer Show last year. I think a calf out of that bull also won the Fat Steer Show at Fort Worth, Texas last year.
Now,
so, I mean, this is a bull that he's the Heisman or the Babe Ruth, if you will, of club calf bulls currently, certainly.
So this is the top bull out there. And traditionally, I guess historically and then more recently, how would bulls like full flush, sire their offspring? I mean, you had the good old-fashioned nature's way, and then you had artificial insemination. Is full flush participated in both?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He's a very active sire. The problem with this bull is that that demand for his genetics exceeds supply. Obviously, if we didn't have an excessive demand compared to supply, there'd be no reason to clone this bull and extend his genetics through the use of copies, somatic cell nuclear transfer copies. And so it's a unique situation, and not every bull, certainly, or very few bulls, will find themselves in the position where the demand for their genetics exceeds supply.
So traditionally, I mean, in your business, you've sold bull semen, and now you're positioning yourself to multiply that supply with
Yes.
clones of full flush.
Yes. Traditionally, the cost of genetics for artificial insemination in the industry is in the $15 to $20 or $25 range, usually between $15 and $20.
The cost of genetics meaning enough semen to impregnate a cow.
One cow, to service one cow one time.
Right.
That's a half cc straw.
Okay.
Okay? And full flush semen currently sells for $50 a unit.
So this is a very valuable animal.
Very valuable animal. And so when semen on this bull was priced at $20 a unit, there was no way we could get close to enough semen on him. So they raised the price. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kephart raised the price to dampen demand. He raised it to $30.
Yep.
At the end of the first season we did that, I was 6,000 units behind. In other words, I had orders for 6,000 units of semen that the bull couldn't produce.
So this is one very popular bull.
Very popular.
Your answer to that was to go out, to take some genetic material from the inside of Full Flush's ear or somewhere.
It was the backside of his ear, but yes.
All right.
Epithelial tissue cells and sent them to a lab.
It happens to be in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Yes.
This is Sciagra.
Called Sciagra.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do with that?
They establish a cell line. Basically, they take that tissue and they chop it up a little bit and put it on a media plate. And the cells then multiply and divide. And the handy thing about epithelial cells is they'll migrate across a plate.
Epithelial being from the back of the ear? Is that what that
yes,
means?
Yes, it's basically skin cells. Epithelial
okay.
cells would be skin cells.
Okay.
And then that tissue was utilized in the somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning process to produce very close to an exact copy of full flush.
Now let's look at that process for just a second. This is the process that was made famous with Dolly the sheep in England in 1996.
Yes.
And this is where they start with an unfertilized egg, as I understand it. They remove the nucleus from that egg and insert the genetic material from the sire, from full flush in this case.
Yes.
And then what this combination is you hit it with an electrical impulse to fuse the two.
Yes, you're completely right.
So, and if that fusion's successful, you get an embryo, and that goes into a surrogate mother.
Yes.
And the offspring that's born is an exact clone. I mean, clone means exact, right, of the sire in this case.
It would not be entirely accurate to say that it is an exact copy. It is, in effect, an exact copy. You have to remember that you have an egg that is provided by a donor animal. Typically, these are animals, these are ovaries from animals that have been slaughtered, and you dissect eggs out of the ovaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so the egg that you are using to produce this embryo is not an egg that is similar or exactly like, I shouldn't say similar, not that it's exactly like or are identical to the egg that produced full flush, because you didn't take those ovaries from full, those ovaries.
So there may be some tiny variation, but you certainly do have a clone here. You've got a clone.
You'll have mitochondrial DNA differences.
Mm-hmm. Now, but you've got, and that's important, we'll come back to it, but at this point you have five clones of full flush. Are they at your ranch or are they in Oklahoma?
I raised those calves from about 2 weeks of age to about 6 months of age, and then I gave them back to Dean Kephart, the owner.
How old are they now?
Coming on 2 years.
Do they look exactly like their father to the eye?
Well, of course, their father is considerably more aged.
But I mean in terms of their structure.
Yes, exactly. You will find that they are, like a lot of identical twins, not exactly the same in appearance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, nutrition, environment, disease incidence, management, and so forth will provide you differences in development, in size, and whatever.
But they appear to have the qualities that made full flush so popular.
Yes. They are extremely similar in appearance.
And when will they be ready to reproduce, or are they already?
Oh, already. We have thousands of units of semen collected and stored awaiting approval by the FDA. I mean, you have to understand that this is that there's a lot of value in the genetics of these animals.
Oh, we get it. We get it. You've got thousands of units of that. And
yes.
when and if the FDA gives you the green light, what will happen with those with the semen from these clones of full flush?
Then we will basically inform the industry that that semen is now available for sale and use, that the FDA has approved, assuming that they do make that decision, has approved the utilization of these genetics and this technology, and then people will call us up and buy that semen, and we will ship it to them, and they will impregnate their cows and produce cattle.
And that will go into the beef stream of the U.S. food supply. How soon do you anticipate that might happen?
Assuming that the FDA approved it tomorrow and we started shipping genetics, the gestation on a cow is about roughly 9 months. It's 285 days, roughly, more or less, depending.
Right.
And so figure 9 to 10 months gestation, another 12 to 15 months or 16 months mm-hmm. in terms of growing those animals to a slaughter or harvest weight.
Right.
So you're talking a couple of years from now.
And the FDA, when do you hope for a green light there?
Well, I would like to have seen the decision made favorably, of course, because I support this technology
mm-hmm.
Before now. But I recognize that the FDA has a lot of constituencies which it must address and be responsible to. I would certainly like to see the FDA have make a decision by the time the next spring breeding season rolls around, which will be towards the middle or end of January or February.
And it sounds like they could do that. Michael Hansen, join us here. You can hear big plans in Don Coover's quarter. And, of course, if it happens there, it'll happen in many regions. You know there's been a lot of research going on this. No conclusion yet, but some fairly positive signs from what we're reading here. Do you expect the FDA to approve clone offspring as you know, ready to flow into the nation's food supply?
Well, they seem to be delaying movement on this. There probably will be some kind of action taken within the next 6 months, although I should say that almost 2 years ago, I was told, or actually last summer, I was told by top people in the FDA that as soon as the National Academy of Sciences report on cloning and genetic engineering were out, that within 2 weeks of that, their clone policy would be out.
And that came out, what, about a year ago, a year plus?
Exactly. That came out in August of 2002,
mm-hmm.
and we still don't have any policy on cloning or genetically engineered animals. And there's this issue is going to come up at a meeting that the FDA is going to hold of their Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee in early November. And they say they're going to discuss a risk assessment for the potential safety of meat and milk from cloned animals. And they would make that available before the meeting, but it's still not up on the FDA's website, and now there's some question as to whether that risk assessment will even be available.
How long is going to happen?
You
know, Don Coover, Michael Hansen, I've got to say, I really felt when I heard this story like I had somehow fallen behind the story here. I mean, the last I remember, Dolly was cloned. It was a big deal. It was a breakthrough. And then there were all kinds of questions, was my impression as a layman watching this, about her health, about the viability of the clone, about exactly how she turned out. She, at a fairly young age, became ill, was euthanized, I think, early this year at age 8. She had, lung problems and arthritis. And I thought that the bottom line, Don Coover, was that clones, the sense I got from reading in the popular media was that clones had problems, that they weren't ready for prime time. But you're ready to go and put it right in the food chain.
Well, I mean, I think you need to understand the circumstances behind Dolly's existence. I mean, she was a multimedia star. She wasn't your average, animal living out in a pasture.
A lot of cameras, a lot of television lights.
Getting
we got
some
that.
Exercise,
yeah.
Eating a natural and common diet that's been proven effective. I mean, I'm sure this animal was in a pen, had dozens or hundreds maybe visitors a month. Everybody wanted to feed it, pet the animal. It got very little exercise.
But it's Dolly's fundamental genetics that we're interested in and the genetics of what's to come as well. Don Coover, Michael Hansen, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about cloned cattle offspring getting ready to enter the nation's food chain. In the debate over cloned livestock, you can join the conversation. If the daddy of your burger was a cloned bull, do you care? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about cloned cattle offspring being prepared to enter the nation's food chain and the debate over cloned livestock. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this just the happy new fruit of science, or is it dangerous tampering with the food supply? Do you want cloning near your dinner plate? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Galesburg, Kansas, by Don Coover. He's a rancher, veterinarian. He owns SEK Genetics, a meat cattle genetics company. Full Flush is one of the beasts in his care, and they've got five cloned bulls from that prize-winning bull who are ready to let loose a new generation of beef cattle into the market. Joining us from New York tonight is Michael Hansen. He's Senior Research Associate at the Consumer Policy Institute, served on the USDA Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology from 1998 to 2002. Michael Hansen, I've heard you tonight say you'd like this to be labeled and maybe some more research, but is it as simple as that? Do you have fundamental concerns here, or is it just about labeling it?
No, there are some concerns with the somatic cell nuclear transplant technology itself. As Mr. Cuvier said, these are not exact genetic replicas. There's some DNA that's in the mitochondria that's in the egg, and there's also some problems with the DNAs that are in the nucleus. We'll just put it this way. It has been found that many cloned laboratory animals, such as mice and rats, when they grow them, they often have all sorts of problems with their immune system and other parts of themselves. There was also a large study done just last year by top researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and they used this technology and cloned some mice, and then they looked carefully at the genes, and they looked at 10,000 genes, and they found that 4% of them were seriously abnormal with the nuclear, with the somatic cell nuclear transplants. And what they said in that Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences report is their conclusion was, quote, "Our results demonstrate frequent abnormal gene expression in clones in which most expression abnormalities appear common to the nuclear transplant procedure, whereas others appear to reflect the particular donor nucleus."
On the other hand, the National Academies came out and said no evidence yet exists that the products from cloned livestock, that would be beef in this case, meat, are unsafe for human consumption. Is that being challenged?
No, it's just that's exactly correct. But if that quote you read from the National Academy of Sciences, if you read the sentence that comes before it, you'll see that that sentence says, quote, "There are to date no published comparative analytical data assessing the composition of milk and meat products of somatic cell clones, their offspring, and conventionally bred animals."
So the real fine-haired, fine-grained side-by-side comparison has yet to be done. I have to admit, I'm having trouble keeping up with the science that is pushing all this forward. But Don Coover, if this is approved, if it goes ahead, how will it change the shape of the, let's say, the beef industry in the United States, the beef cattle industry?
Well, you have to understand that somatic cell nuclear transfer technology, because it's so expensive,
that's cloning.
Cloning is only somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. There are other types of cloning, and I think it's important that we distinguish between
point
them.
Point taken.
But past that, the animals that will that this technology will be utilized to extend and preserve their genetics are going to be a minuscule portion of the population,
because
really.
those will just be most likely bulls, because they can have their semen harvested.
Actually, I suspect that eventually this technology will do more for the female side of the industry than it will do for the male side.
So they'll clone the big milk producers. Is that what you mean?
Yes, and the reason for that is it's very easy right now to extend widely popular genetics of bulls, because you can freeze semen and because you can produce so much more semen.
Then you can eggs from the
cow. Then you can eggs from a cow, exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that this technology, when the cost gets down and the efficiencies improve, and if it is approved for use, I think that this technology will do much more for the female side of the industry than it may potentially do for the male side. But above and beyond that, you have to remember that the animals that justify this kind of an economic investment are few and far between.
Yeah, but once you find them and you make the investment, I mean, is it possible that some huge portion of the, let's say, U.S. population of beef cattle would have the same papa?
I wouldn't say a huge portion. Probably not, because those genetics tend to be utilized with a certain nutritional environment, nutritional program, environmental program, management philosophy, and so forth. So no, you're not going to see that. I mean, only about 4 or 5% of the beef cattle in the United States right now are artificially inseminated anyway, and most of those are heifers because of calving difficulties with, you know, with bulls that have big birth weights. And so you try to select for those light birth weight bulls you use on those heifers.
And cloned offspring tend to have higher birth weights.
Not necessarily, actually. I'm not sure that that's the case.
Oh,
I'm not
I've
sure
read
it's
that
not
here.
Either. Mm-hmm. I think that you're going to see some anomalies in birthing process, and I believe that what he, you know, I do believe that there may be problems with rats and mice, and there may be problems with other species. I can tell you that my very limited experience raising clones, which is certainly more extensive than most people's experience, suggests that those animals are as normal in every respect as every other calf I've ever raised.
So if 3 years from now, Don Cooper, you're sitting down to a big beefsteak dinner and it's the offspring of a cloned bull, do you have any hesitation?
Oh, absolutely not. Somatic cell nuclear transfer clones are very similar to somatic cell clones that occur naturally in nature, which would be identical twins. I have no aversion and no apprehension about eating, you know, a steak from an animal that was born as an identical twin to some other. I will be the very first to grant that this is a revolutionary technology. I'd suggest it's more evolutionary in application and effect on the industry, you know, than people are making it sound.
Ladies and gentlemen, things are moving quickly here. Dolly, 1996, right. and pretty soon maybe we're ready for clone burgers. I want to turn to our calls. Ruth's calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Rush, I'm sorry. Hi, Rush, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Rush.
Yes, got it, Rush.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hey, I don't buy it, and that's enough for me to give up eating meat.
What is it that you don't buy exactly, Rush?
Well, the fact that they can implement something or attempt to implement something like this and experiment on more than the individual palate. You're introducing food into the American diet that has basically the experiment is being done on the people, on the consumers that are consuming the product.
Well, it's not yet, but I guess you might look at it that way
right.
one day.
And if you slaughter a critter to get it to market, you're not going to see a lot of the anomalies that were observed with Dolly.
So you're afraid that there might be something, whether it's perceived or not, wrong with the genetics or the meat of that offspring.
Right. The technology is driving the whole shooting match. There's no legislation or anything really to protect consumers. I mean, you can't even get labeling on genetically modified food products.
Well, the FDA is out there working on it, but if it was in the grocery store, you know, the meat shelf, and it's labeled, you know, clone meat, non-clone meat, do you have a choice?
You do have a choice, and basically it's you know, to my way of thinking, it's reducing the diversity that nature provides. I mean, the Irish were just about wiped out in a potato famine. I mean, because of the biodiversity that is naturally occurring in nature and the fact that it's not so concentrated and reduced to the level where it's so controlled by so few and so driven by money and control of basic commodity.
Well, there's been a lot of animal husbandry, I suppose, narrowing down the field toward animals that you know, ranchers and others wanted for a long time. But this is a direct copy. Rush, thanks a lot for your call. I want to turn now to Paul Billings. He joins us from Berkeley, California. He's chairman of the board of the Council for Responsible Genetics. It's an organization that studies the ethical issues surrounding biotechnology. He's a geneticist and physician. Good evening and welcome, Paul Billings.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Paul Billings, wade in here with us and help us out. Don Cooper is describing what's going on. He's not the only one doing this. We've got lots of young bulls ready to sire offspring that are going to be in the American meat supply soon if the FDA signs off. You've looked closely at these issues. It sounds kind of intimidating to a layperson's ear. Is this A-OK? Off we go? Or are there potential problems here?
Well, you know, first of all, we're not talking about, and I think Michael Hansen mentioned this, we're not talking here about genetically engineered animals. We're talking about applying cloning technology to the cow and the bull breeding industry, which is already full of assisted reproductive techniques. I mean, I think we were told earlier that most most of the breeding is done by artificial insemination at this point anyway. So this is not, you know, the sort of bucolic nature kind of thing.
But artificial insemination is still a big step away from
indeed.
Cloning.
And the second thing I would say is that we're not really talking here about eating the clones. We're talking about eating the offspring or using the products of the clones.
We've got that. We understand that. But I mean, once you know the clone is the papa or the mama if it's
right.
the milk, and so you're eating the genetic offspring of that clone.
You're talking about eating the next generation or using
right.
the milk of the next generation, and that's of course diluted by the other parent. You know, the mother.
We got that. But I guess that the icon sitting there is Dolly, and she didn't look appetizing.
Well,
she was presented as sickly,
and
gimpy.
Let me finish, though. So
yes, please.
Our view is that one should approach this with precaution to some extent, and that you've touched upon a lot of the issues. Cloning as a technique causes birth anomalies and causes genetic changes. Some of those result in the clone pregnancy not taking hold.
Mm-hmm.
Some result in birth defects in the calves or the mice or the rats or whatever you're cloning. Some survive, and some might even survive and produce sperm. Now, whether those sperm will give you in the next generation what you're looking for is open to question if there have been some changes that occurred because of the cloning process. Just like when you take a great horse like Secretariat mm-hmm. and ask him to produce sperm and ask him whether his offspring are great horses, the answer is not really, not that great. You know, so the predictability, there's issues about what you get in the next generation. So that's one thing. Second of all, mm-hmm. You've raised the issue of whether if one, you know, the sperm of one bull and its clones becomes a significant part of the marketplace, and there may be restraints on the marketplace due to cost and availability of that
right.
sperm, what would happen?
And our caller Rush raised the issue of diversity, which...
Right,
which,
I think that's a reasonable thing, and I think we ought to be somewhat concerned about that. That may not come to bear, but if we had a monoculture of cows in this country, then one infection might wipe them all out, which another cow might resist because if it had a different genetic background.
So even if you don't have a monoculture with just one set of parents of the whole cattle population, if it even is changed by some percentage, does that make a difference in terms of the safety of that animal livestock population?
There are some scientists who think they know the answer to this question. The answer is I don't think we know, and we have to move with a certain amount of reasonable caution in this area. The final point I would make is that the FDA is charged with the safety of human health in the United States. They, you know, for instance, in drugs, they're charged to show that the drugs are safe and efficacious. And in this case, we're talking about whether the meat supply and the milk,
mm-hmm.
presumably,
mm-hmm.
That occur when a biotechnology technique is applied to animals, it results in safety. Now, I think that if the FDA has, takes reasonable steps to assess this and does gather the data that it should, then they say that they can detect, and they say how they've detected it, tried to detect it, can't detect any problems here. I think then that we're talking about a tempest in a teapot here. I actually think that this we ought to, if the marketplace and farmers want to do this, we ought to let them do it as long as it is labeled and as long as people, the end user, the consumer, can tell whether they're eating the products of a clone situation or eating products of the normal artificially inseminated situation.
So clone away and eat up America. Technology is moving quickly here. Listeners, what do you think? David's calling from Somerset, Kentucky. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Just great, thanks. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that I think this cloning process is great. I think there's a lot of good that's going to come out of it, not only with just, you know, you're basically getting better meat and milk, but I think that every time that there's experimental research like that, always great things come from it that people don't see. I just want to say that I'm definitely supportive of what you guys are doing. And I had a quick question. Versus using sperm and an egg to reproduce an animal, how exactly do you guys gather DNA from somebody or, you know, a cow and clone them versus, you know, if somebody could get my hair, they get out of my hairbrush and clone me? How's that process done?
Okay, so human cloning, animal cloning. David, thanks for your call. Paul Billings, let me put that to you.
Sure.
Is it the same, somatic cell nuclear transfer? Could it be used also for human beings?
Well, sure. I mean, technically, if you can extract a nucleus with a whole genome in it, you can place that in the environment of a female gamete, an ovum, which has been had its own nucleus taken out, and put this new nucleus in, and activate that ovum to divide and become and to develop.
And could that happen as easily from a human skin cell as from the cattle skin cell Don Cooper was describing?
In principle, this can be done. What has been determined worldwide, and you know, for instance, here in California, there's a ban on anyone doing that. Is that that's an unsafe human procedure, and that the resultant the process results in enough pain and suffering and uncertainty that it should not be done as a reproductive technique.
And if it's unsafe for humans, why is it not unsafe for livestock? What's the difference, the distinction being drawn there?
Well, what's the distinction is being drawn is that you're talking about potentially birthing kids who with significant birth defects or mental retardation or other kinds of bad things. And we don't, you know, if there's a process that we know has a significant risk of doing that, and we know that from the animal data, that it shouldn't be done in humans. And it's the same thing. That's the point I just made, which is the person who wants to clone this is using the live-born clones. The fact is that the cloner is probably losing a lot of early embryos in the cloning process because they're defective. They're not developing.
But that wastage we've learned to accept in livestock, but you bring it to humans and you've got all kinds of moral issues.
Well, it's not a question of morals. You might be creating a birth defective child, which and why do that if you have other ways of having kids which, you know, don't have that risk or have less of that risk, I guess is the way to put it.
But it seems to me there has been a moral umbrella or conversation around the whole issue of human cloning. Yeah. On the other hand, if it's perfected in livestock, you can't help but wonder whether it doesn't jump the gap.
That, you know, there is, you're raising an issue. In humans, people have objected to cloning in part because it kind of commodifies reproduction, and it's a kind of mechanical. It takes, you know, it's done with only one parent instead of two, and so forth. It can be done with only one parent instead of two. And I think there's some, you know, question about how much we want to mechanize reproduction at any level of life, including this kind of mechanized industrial type of cow culture that we're creating.
I guess so. Paul Billings, Michael Hansen, Don Cooper, stand by. You are all laying out a horizon that has an awful lot of new features to me. Listeners, you can join this conversation. We're talking tonight about cloned cattle offspring being prepared to enter the nation's food supply. What do you think? What do you need to know to be confident that clone burgers are safe to eat? And should the son of a clone sirloin be labeled as clone-generated meat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about cloned cattle offspring being prepared to enter the nation's food supply and the debate over cloned livestock. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you want cloning near your dinner plate? Is this just the happy fruit of science, or is it dangerous tampering with the food chain? And I guess, off our last caller, if we're cloning bulls right and left, how long until we're cloning boys and girls? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Don Cooper. He's a rancher and veterinarian, owns SEK Genetics, a meat cattle genetics company. He's got full flush, already cloned in 5 young bulls who are ready to go. Michael Hansen's with us from the Consumer Policy Institute. And from Berkeley, California tonight, Paul Billings. He's chairman of the board of the Council for Responsible Genetics. Right now, John's calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was a member of the National Academy Committee that wrote the report that's been mentioned a couple of times.
That came out 12 or 14 months ago?
That's absolutely correct.
And what's your sense then, John, of where this is headed?
My sense is that there's nothing there. The committee discussed this and met with experts from all kinds of areas and people pro and con, and really could come up with no reason to think at all that there is anything at issue in terms of the safety of eating cloned animal products.
So it sounds like you're ready to give the green light, but help us with the image that still sits there in the public mind. And Don Coover spoke to this, but the image of Dolly, not healthy, euthanized young, arthritis, lung degenerative lung condition, and the sense that this just wasn't really a fully vibrant creature that had been produced by cloning. Was that just Dolly's bad luck to be in a pen with TV lights all around? Hello, John, are you there?
A new animal, it's a hybrid between just two strains, for example. You're eating a new genetic experiment. The difference in sort of in gene expression and the other characteristics that you see cannot by any stretch of the imagination really reflect on their edibility unless there is something obviously wrong. And all we recommended, the committee recommended to do was to test for the obvious.
To test for the obvious. So if, let's say, these bulls who have been cloned, if it emerges that they don't have the same longevity as naturally reproduced bulls, that they're, I don't know, just hypothetically here, that they're dying at age 7 or 8 from degenerative lung disease, you're saying go ahead and eat the meat of their offspring anyway? It doesn't matter?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as far as their edibility is concerned, I don't see how that kind of thing, I don't see how it can have an effect. There have been lots of mutant animals that have been sort of found and is naturally occurring that have all of these kinds of properties and different properties, and none of that has ever been an issue.
John, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Paul Billings, help us out here. I mean, it seems to me that traditionally human beings would look at mutant animals and shy away from eating their offspring.
Look, mutations happen all the time. I mean, mutations, we've traditionally only been able to detect the ones which created, you know, some birth anomaly,
visible
change in color, you know, some trait that we could easily detect. Now,
yes.
Now that we have the techniques to be able to detect changes in DNA right at the DNA level, we know that mutations happen all the time. And we're eating, in our food supply, there's all sorts of mutant meat. And we've been eating it for thousands and thousands of years, and it's not caused any trouble, or at least not any more trouble than raising our cholesterol and killing us in other ways. But the point is that it's basically been happening in nature all along. And so, yes, you know, if this technique increases mutation rates, we ought to take a look and see if that makes any big difference. But the bottom line is, there's mutant meat out there anyway, and we oughtn't really be terribly concerned about that.
Michael Hansen, it sounds like we've got the community gearing up here to put that cloned offspring right on the plate. Bring out the carving knife.
Well, that's what some people say, but again, I go back to there have been scientific studies that have found this abnormality in gene expression when they compare cloning to not cloning. So there is a difference. It might not lead to a food safety difference, but just to say that to blithely say, well, we've been eating mutants all along, we don't know. This is a new technology. The way that they're doing the cloning does, in fact, not happen naturally, because when organisms reproduce, they can tell, the embryo knows which genes came from the mother, which genes came from the father, and not all of them are turned on. Some of them are often turned off. They tend to come from one parent. When you do this somatic cell nuclear transplants, they can't tell anymore, and so you run into these problems. In fact, many of these 4% of the 10,000 genes that were abnormal, they had linked to this phenomena of genetic imprinting. So it might not be a problem, but just to blithely say, well, we've been eating mutant animals, and besides, it's the offspring of the mutant animals, you could say the same thing with a genetically engineered plant. Well, you're not really eating the plant. We're crossing that plant with traditional ones and eating the offspring. The issue of if there is a genetic change or is something that might impact on the quality or safety of the meat, that should be assessed. We shouldn't just say, well, these look the same. These look like they're perfectly healthy, and they look the same, so therefore they must be okay.
But Michael Hansen, that's exactly what the National Academy said should be done. They said it was hard to compare the meat itself, and more research needed to be done on that. Are you confident that's going to be done before a green light's given?
That's what we have to see. That is the $64,000 question. As the National Academy says, there are no studies to date, and they said, quote, the committee found it difficult to characterize the level of concern without further supporting evidence regarding the food product. So that means you have to base this on data, not just on, well, we've been doing forms of mutants have occurred before, they've been safe, so this must be safe. We need to base it on data.
Looking for some new data here. Mike is right. calling from Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good show. Thanks much.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I'd like to overstep the food safety and edibility thing. That's a red herring at this point. I'd like to point out the economic purpose of this whole thing. The good doctor there, his reason for starting this whole thing is basically because supply and demand. He didn't have enough semen. There was a demand. Well, we got to get it. We got to.
Yeah, and Don Cooper's very upfront about that. That's
right.
We
have to get our super steer. Economically speaking, this is a link in the long chain of the monopolization of our food supply, as far as milk and beef.
Oh, you think this will change the economics of the beef industry, of farming?
Yes, yes, very much. I've worked on beef farms, and because whoever has the money can get the genetics to supply all these big companies to raise the animals that have the most milk and the most meat output. Thereby, that's going to cause the other prices to go down. They're going to stand out front. They'll get the contracts with the McDonald's, the public schools, the Taco Bells. That's how that goes.
Mike, now that's a great insight that I hadn't really thought about. You're saying the super steers, the clones, will end up in the hands of very big companies that will dominate. Don Cooper, what do you think? Will it work that way?
I don't think so, actually. In fact, I believe that this technological advancement will give the small family farmer and producer the advantage of quality over quantity. And obviously the big outfits enjoy the advantage of numbers already. So I would suggest to you that it's the other way around. I'd suggest to you that those animal breeders, and the best ones tend to be small, intensively managed operations,
yeah.
not great big ranches, that produce these excellent individuals, tend to be, the people that produce these, the organizations that produce these, tend to be small breeders that know exactly what they're up against and what they're after.
But they could end up being the ones who produce the super steers, but not the ones who really dominate the industry. They could provide the prize winners, but...
Yes, but here's the advantage to cloning. The ability to clone these animals and produce additional copies of these great individuals gives these small operators the advantage of quality over quantity. And they can, in fact, sell the same animal several times as opposed to a single time or only once.
Well, that's just in the genetic end of it, though. But what about the meat production end? Is this more likely to concentrate the industry in the hands of a few big meat-producing companies?
Actually, the industry already is concentrated. The packers are very concentrated. There's only a few feeders compared to what there was, say,
yeah,
a decade ago.
That's for sure. Mike?
But most of the small producers, there's an awful lot of small producers out there, and they have to depend upon premium prices for premium products in order to compete with the big outfits that have thousands or tens of thousands of animals.
Got it. Caller Mike in Minnesota, you hear Don Cooper saying, hey, this has already happened. It's already dominated by a few big companies.
Right.
So what's the further distinction that you're making?
As far as a small farmer goes, well, people will pay a premium for grain-fed, free-range animals. They will pay that price for a small farmer. That's not a problem. What this does is whoever has the money for the genetics gets the bigger steer, gets the bigger contracts, forces a smaller person out. They don't have the available. A small farmer, they're losing contact with a small farmer, doesn't have the money or even the ethics to send a portion of a DNA to a lab to have it grown in a petri dish, to have it thereby to compete with IBP or something like that. That's not the mindset of this.
I mean, that traditionally hasn't been. It's not the way it worked on the farm I grew up on, but maybe in the future it is.
And Tom, one other point. Just I wish the good doctor, the veterinarian in Kansas, the best of luck. And I wish he'd read a book called A Brave New World. I believe it was 1954, not even 50 years. And he was so far ahead of his time.
What, Huxley?
Yes, please. And it's a scary new world.
It is scary. I find myself trying to catch up myself tonight. But, Mike, thanks very much for your call. Rodney's calling from Boston. Hi, Rodney. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I would support the man from Minnesota. But I was calling with two concerns. The first was that I, for one, don't trust the government with regulating or labeling the parts of our food supply that are subject to genetic engineering.
Why not? They've regulated food supply for a long time. Americans are generally healthy.
Right, and I, for one, am not satisfied with their track record, specifically around the issues of the use of bovine growth hormones in our dairy supply.
Right.
And with the use of genetically modified crops, and as a part of that, its effects upon the segment that I'm most familiar with, which is organic farming.
So you don't trust that the labels will be there, that this will be finally followed?
Right. So using the dairy example, for example, we have a large part of our dairy supply is produced with the use of bovine growth hormone. And even for those farms and dairies that want to say, we don't use this, the FDA has been so sort of accommodating of the use of bovine growth hormones that even those who abstain are suppressed from doing that.
Yep, we've got it. So you're not holding your breath for the labeling. And thanks for your call, Rodney. Paul Billings, look way out with us here. You're listening to this conversation. I'm sure there's a public opinion that's going to have to catch up with the science as this comes forward. But what do you hear? Is this just a kind of troglodyte public who's just not caught up with the science? Are we looking at look way out, look way ahead? Are we going to see, I don't know, meat grown, you know, that'll be grown right in the box, right in the package somehow? Does it matter if it's grown on the hoof?
I agree with Michael Hansen. There are real uncertainties about the safety of this technique, of new hormones used to increase various traits of animals, of genetic, you know, transgenic modification of animals and plants. There are real concerns that we are disturbing a evolutionary created ecological system, and that the harms of doing that may exceed the industrial aims that we and the increase in production aims of that we're trying to do that. That is the role of agencies like the government, and we understand that those are political agencies, but that's the role that they're supposed to do. They're supposed to make those hard calls and to protect us and tell, on balance, these things are safe. And then, even when they do make those determinations, they're, you know, look at our prescriptions. There are intensive labels on those prescriptions about what's known and what's not known about that. And so, I think that what we're going to see is a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of varieties, people trying things like our friend in Kansas with the sperm in the genetics business.
Yep.
And all I hope is that we, A, do try to get data to make sure that it is safe, and B, let the consumer, you know, when it's deemed safe enough to get to the consumer, then let the consumer make that choice.
Well, a lot of God to be played here. Paul Billings, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure, happy to be with you.
Paul Billings in Berkeley, California, chairman of the Council for Responsible Genetics. Michael Hansen with the Consumer Policy Institute, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Don Coover there in Galesburg, Kansas, 6,000 units of that semen ready to go. And how many more each month?
Well, right now we have them out of production because we're waiting for a go-ahead before we sink any more money into it.
We've got it. Waiting for that green light. Sounds like it might come. Don Coover, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.